But his major contribution at this period was a tree which later came to bear his name. He found it growing near Bombay, and when he first tasted its fruit, he cried, "This tree we've got to have in Hawaii." Accordingly, he shipped 4 saplings home, but they died. He ordered 4 more and directed them to be planted in Kona on the Big Island, but they also died. He got 4 more, each in its own washtub of Bombay soil, and it was these that grew. When they produced their first fruit, a handsome hard rind that turned gold and red and speckled green, inside of which rested a big flat seed surrounded by delicious yellow meat, his neighbors asked what strange thing he had this time. "Watch," he said crisply, "you're about to taste the king of fruits." He gripped one, took out his knife, and gashed a complete circle around the long axis. Then he spun the knife point over end into the tree, and with 2 hands gripped the halves of the fruit, twisting them in opposite directions. The fruit tore apart, and for the first time the people of Hawaii tasted Whip's luscious discovery. "Like baked nuts with a touch of apple," one man judged. "Something like a peach with a trace of turpentine," another said. "What is it, Whip?" "A Bombay mango," Hawksworth replied. "We used to have mangoes around here years ago," the man replied, "but as I recall, they were stringy. Couldn't hardly eat 'em." "There are mangoes and mangoes," Whip agreed. "Trick is to find the good ones, then take care of them." In later years, many people grew to despise Wild Whip Hawksworth, for he developed into the ruthless operator his grandfather had been. The extension of H&H from merely a strong shipping line into the dictator company of the islands was not accomplished easily. And if men hated Wild Whip, they had a right to. But no one ever failed to remember with keen appreciation his first major gift to Hawaii. Whenever a hungry man reached up, knocked down a Hawksworth mango, circled it with his knife, and sucked in the aromatic fruit, he instinctively paid tribute to Wild Whip. Other varieties came later, but the Hawksworth remained what its discoverer had once claimed it to be, the king of fruits. When Whip saw his mangoes established and had given several hundred saplings away to his friends, he turned his attention to the affairs of H&H, whereupon he ran headfirst into his bearded uncle, stern Micah Hale, a symbol of rectitude and a man determined not to have the H&H empire sullied by the escapades of his wild young nephew. Consequently, there was no opening for Whip. When he applied for a job, his grim-faced uncle stared at him over his copious beard and said, "You've outraged all the girls in our family, young man, and we have no place for you." "I'm not applying for a wife," Whip snapped. "I'm applying for a job." "A man who isn't appropriate for a husband isn't appropriate for a job, not with H&H, Uncle Micah replied, enunciating one of the firmest rocks of his company's policies. For like most of the great emperors of history, the Hales and Whipples and Janderses realized that an institution had to go forward on 2 levels. It produced intelligent sons to carry on when the old man died, and it produced beautiful daughters to lure able young husbands into the enterprise. It was an open question as to whether the great families of Hawaii prospered most from selling sugar at a good price or their daughters to good husbands. "There's no place for you in H&H, Uncle Micah said with finality. When Whip appealed to his father, he found that sensitive and confused weakling quite unwilling to fight with Micah, who now controlled the family ventures. "Your behavior has been such," Whip's father began plaintively, whereupon his son said, "Stow it." There was a good deal of argument within the family, but Uncle Micah said firmly, "Our success in Hawaii depends upon our presenting to the public an attitude of the most strict rectitude. There has never been a scandal in the big firms, and there won't be as long as I control them. I think that Whipple ought to go back to sea. will reward him justly for his part ownership of the business, but he must stay out of Hawaii. And then Clever Micah thought of a happy solution. Recalling his nephew's interest in growing things, he suggested a compromise. Wild Whip would divorce himself completely from all H&H Enterprises, and an announcement of this fact would be made public so as to absolve men like Micah Hale and Bromley Hawksworth from responsibility for his future actions. And in return, Whip would be given 4,000 acres of the family's land to do with as he wished. When the assembled Hawksworths and Hales delivered this ultimatum to their errant son, Wild Whip smiled graciously, accepted the 4,000 acres, and said evenly, "Jesus, are you goddamn missionaries going to regret this day?" He harnessed up two good horses and started westward to survey the lands he had been given. He drove some distance out of town, shaking the dust from his nose and staring at the bleak, grassless hills that rose to his right. Above them stood the barren mountains of the Koolau Range, and as far as he could see, nothing grew. He drove past Pearl Harbor and out to where the land began to level off between the Koolau Mountains to the right and the Waianae Range to the left. Ahead lay his land. It was bleak, barren, profitless. Looking at it, he recalled his Uncle Micah's description of the deserts of Western America when that young minister traversed them in 1849. They were lands where nothing grew, not even grass. Grimly amused, Wild Whip tied his horses to a rock, for there were no trees, and got out to study his inheritance at closer quarters. When he kicked away the surface growth of lichen and dried scrub grass, he found that the soil was a rich reddish color that his grandfather Whipple had once explained as the result of the gradual breaking down of volcanic rocks. "It's rich in iron," Whip mused. "Probably grow things like mad if it could get water." He looked back at Pearl Harbor and saw the wide expanse of salt seawater, useless to a farmer. He looked up at the sky and saw no clouds, for few arrived here with rain. And then he happened to look toward the Koolau Range to his right, and above its peaks he saw many dark clouds, riding in upon the trade winds that bore down constantly from the northeast, and he could almost smell the water falling out of those clouds. It fell, of course, on the other side of the mountains, and gushed furiously down steep valleys and back out to sea. His grandfather Whipple had trapped a little in his ditches, but the bulk was as useless as the salt water of Pearl Harbor. It was then that his great design came to him. Why not build a tunnel right through the mountains and bring that water over here? He visualized a system of ditches and dikes, all serving to bring the rich waters of the other side down to his parched lands. "I'll build that tunnel," he swore. "I'll make this land so rich that by comparison Uncle Micah's boats will be worth nothing." He pointed his lone right forefinger at the Koolau Range and announced to those impassive giants, "Someday I'm gonna walk right through your bowels. Be ready." Curiously, Whip's great fortune was built in quite a different manner. When he saw that he was not wanted in his family's business, and when he had finished inspecting his imperial and useless acres, he decided to leave Hawaii, and he did so in memorable fashion. He had never forgotten how relatively pleasant it had been sleeping surreptitiously with his responsive cousin, Nancy Janders, still banished to the mainland. And now, as he was about to leave, he began paying deadly court to her saucy younger sister, Iliki. It was a whirlwind affair, interspersed with wild nights in Rat Alley with a little French girl, and it culminated in pretty Iliki's slipping into men's clothes as a passenger aboard a British freighter, whose captain married her to Whip on the journey to San Francisco. When the joint families heard of the scandal, they prayed that young Iliki would find a happiness which they felt sure would escape her. But when, in America, Iliki's older sister Nancy heard of the marriage, she cried, "Damn them! Damn them! I hope they both live in hell." Wild Whip didn't, because he found considerable joy in his lively cousin. But Ilike did, for she discovered to her consternation and embarrassment that her husband had no intention of being loyal to her or of giving up his customary visits to local brothels. In San Francisco, he had dashing affairs with several married women of otherwise good repute, and a running relationship with two popular Spanish courtesans from a waterfront institution of ill fame. In other ways, he was a good husband, and when his son was born in 1880, he insisted that the boy be named Janders Hawksworth after his wife's father. He proved himself to be a doting husband, and was obviously pleased to parade on Sunday after church with his wife on his arm, and his son surrounded by lace in the perambulator which he proudly pushed. But in late 1880, Ilike's sister visited them on her way back to Honolulu, and Nancy was now a striking New York beauty, and it was not long before Nancy's hatred of Wild Whip became once more the passionate love she had earlier known for this gallant gentleman. At first, Whip sneaked away to Nancy's hotel, where they fell into wild, tormenting embraces. All the longing of 3 years rushed back upon poor Nancy Janders, and she abandoned restraint. She would lie in bed, completely undressed, waiting for Whip to bound up the hotel stairs, and as soon as he burst into the room and locked the door, she would spring upon him and kiss him madly, throwing him onto the bed with laughter that welled up from her entire being. Sometimes she kept him imprisoned for a whole day, and it became obvious to her sister Ilike what was going on. At first, the gay little wife could not imagine what she ought to do. She wondered whether she was supposed to break into the hotel room and confront the guilty pair, or whether custom required her to weep silently. But her problems were resolved when on a day which took her shopping, she returned unexpectedly to find that bold Nancy had trailed Whip to his own home, had undressed in Ilike's room, and had pulled Whip into bed with her. When Ilike arrived, they stared up at her from her own sheets. Nobody made a scene. Nancy pouted. "I had him first. He's decided to stay with me." "Put some clothes on," Ilike said, amazed at her restraint. When they were dressed, Nancy announced defiantly, "Whip and I are going to live together." Ilike did not bother to argue with her husband, for she knew that no matter what he promised, it was of no consequence. He was not like other men. And with deep sorrow, for she loved him very much, she saw that he was destined to bounce from one woman to another without ever resting with one, and she thought, "He'll have a very lonely life." She left San Francisco with her son Janders and returned on an H&H liner to Honolulu, where she lived a long, full life as a divorcee, doing much good in the community. The Natural History Museum flourished largely because of her energies. Her husband Whip and her sister Nancy enjoyed a wild time in San Francisco. Whip got a formal divorce but did not bother to marry Nancy because, as he pointed out, "I'll never make a good husband." Nancy, finding in sex a complete gratification, was content to tag along on whatever terms he proposed. Nor was she distressed when she uncovered suspicious circumstances that seemed to prove that her companion was also the consort of several well-known waterfront girls. What she liked best, however, apart from the passionate moments when he came home after a long absence, were the intense days when he took her with him to talk with men who had built tunnels. They were an odd, dedicated group of experts, willing to tackle nature on any terms, and they convinced Whip that if he could scrape together enough money, they could penetrate the Ku'ulao Mountains and bring water to his dusty lands. Surreptitiously, he sent one of the engineer geologists to Hawaii, and in the guise of bird collecting, this keen fellow tramped the Ku'ulaos and satisfied himself that tunneling them would present no unusual problems. "As a matter of fact," he reported, "it looks to me as if the mountains were built in layers tilted on end. If that's true, when you drill your tunnel, you'll not only collect all the water you trap in outside ditches to lead into your tunnel, but the porous rock above the tunnel will probably deliver an equal amount of its own. this could be a profitable undertaking so far as water is concerned. How long would the tunnel have to be? 8, 10 miles, the engineer replied. Can you build a tunnel that long? Whip asked. Any tunnel is simply a function of money, the engineer replied. If you've got the money, I can get the dynamite. In this case, how much? 4 million. Don't forget my name, Whip said. This report seemed to be the final answer to Whip's land problem. He didn't have the $4 million then, but there was always a chance he might one day have it. He therefore decided to return to Hawaii, but Nancy Jander said, I wouldn't, Whip. Why not? Well, Iliki's there. That'll be embarrassing for you, and I certainly can't go back with you. I don't think you should, Whip said coldly, and a few days later he added, You ought to be looking for a man for yourself, Nance. You through with me? Nancy asked. No place for you in Hawaii, he said truthfully. How you fixed for money? The family sends me my share, she assured him. Nance, he said in his most friendly manner, I sure hope you have a wonderful life from here on out. Now you better get some clothes on. She had been gone only a few hours when there was a knock at his hotel room door, and a little man in an overcoat that reached down to his ankles entered. My name's Overpeck, Milton Overpeck, and I hear you're interested in drilling a tunnel. That's right, Whip said. Sit down, Mr. Overpeck. You like whiskey? I like anything, Overpeck said. You a tunnel man? Well, yes and no, the little man replied, gulping a huge draught of whiskey. Coughing slightly, he asked, I understand you're drilling your tunnel in order to get water. You followed me around pretty well, Mr. Overpeck. Another whiskey? Look, son, if you calculate on getting me drunk and outsmarting me, quit now, because you simply can't do it. I'm offering it in hospitality, Whip assured him. I never accept hospitality unless the host joins me. Now you gulp one down and catch up, and we can have a fine talk. The two men, Whip Hawksworth, 24 years old, and Milton Overpeck in his early 50s, guzzled straight whiskey for several hours, during which the little engineer fascinated the Hawaiian landowner with a completely new theory about water. The doughty drinker, whose eyes were bright and clear after three quarters of a bottle, apparently knew more about Hawaii than Whip did, at least about the island of Oahu. My theory is this, he explained, using pillows, books, and newspapers to build his island. This volcano here and this one here built Oahu. That's perfectly obvious. Now, as they built, one surely must have overflowed the rightful terrain of the other. I judge all volcanic rock to be porous, so in Oahu it seems to me you have got to have a complex substructure, the bulk of it porous. All the fine water that falls on your island doesn't run immediately out to sea. Well, the engineer I sent out there did say that he thought the mountains were probably porous, Whip remembered. I'm not interested in the mountains you see above land, Overpeck snapped. I'm interested in the subterranean ones. Because if, as I suspect, there was a rising and a falling of the entire mountain mass... He stopped, studied his friend, and said, Sorry, you're drunk. I'll be back in the morning. But as he was about to leave, he said, Don't sleep on a pillow tonight. Leave everything just as it is. Whip, through bleary eyes, tried to focus on the turmoil in his room and asked, What's all this got to do with tunnels? I wouldn't know, Overpeck replied. I'm a well man myself. He appeared at 7 next morning, chipper as a woodchuck, his long overcoat flapping about his ankles in the cold San Francisco weather. He surprised Whip by completely dismissing the intricate construction of pillows, books, and newspapers. Best thing is to show you, he said cheerily. Wells'll be the making of Hawaii. And he led Whip down to the foot of Market Street, where grimy ferries left for the other side of the bay. and when, after a long walk through Oakland, they stood before a well he had recently dug, he pointed with unconcealed admiration at a pipe protruding from the ground, from which gushed a steady volume of water that rose 14 feet into the air. "Does it run like this all the time?" Whip asked. "Day and night," Overpeck replied. "What does it?" "Artesian, that's what it is, artesian." "How many gallons a day?"
1,000,004.
"How long will it last?"
"Forever."
This was what Wild Whip had been dreaming of, a steady source of fresh water. But he had imagined that the only way to get it was to drive a tunnel through the mountains. If Overpeck were correct, where the water really lay was at his feet. But in business, Whip was both daring and cautious. He was willing to take almost any gamble to obtain water, but he wanted assurance that he had at least a fair chance of winning. Carefully, he asked, "Why did you have to bring me all the way over here to show me this well? Why didn't you show me one in San Francisco?"
"Artesian water don't happen everywhere," Overpeck replied.
"Suppose there isn't any on my land in Hawaii?"
"My job is to guess where it is," Overpeck answered, "and I guess it's under your land."
"Why?"
"That's what I was explaining with the pillows and the newspapers," he said.
"I think we better go back to the hotel," Whip said.
"But wait a minute. How did you get the well down there?"
"A special rig I invented."
"How far down did you go?"
180 feet.
"You want to sell the rig?"
"Nope."
"I didn't think so."
The two men returned to the ferry, and as Whip studied the cold and windy hills of San Francisco, imagining them to be Hawaii, he became increasingly excited. But when little Mr. Overpeck assured him that a layer of cap rock must have imprisoned enormous stores of sweet water under the sloping flatlands of Oahu, Whip could feel actual perspiration break out on his forehead.
"What kind of deal can we make, Overpeck?" he asked bluntly.
"You're sweating, son. If I find water, I'm handing you millions of dollars, ain't I?"
"You are."
"I'm a gambler, Mr. Hawksworth. What I want is the land next to yours."
"How much?"
"You pay for getting the rig over there. You give me $3 a day. And you buy, before we start, 1,000 acres of land. If we get water, I buy it from you for what you paid. If we don't, you keep it."
"Are the chances good?"
"There's one way we can test my theory without spending a cent."
"How?"
"Think a minute. If there really is a pool of inexhaustible water hiding under your land, the overflow has got to be escaping somewhere. Logically, it's running away under the sea level, but some of it must be seeping up.